Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Netta Ulibi. This week on Culturetopia, Brad Pitt on his role in the latest Terrence Malick film, The Tree of Life. Critics are calling it a career-defining performance. NPR's movie critic Bob Mondello on his weekend spent buried in the new essential collection of Stanley Kubrick's films. And the origins of techno in Detroit in the 1970s and 80s. But first,
in the best-selling memoir, Running with Scissors, Augustin Burroughs told of his bizarre and sometimes brutal upbringing. His brother, John Elder Robison, then wrote his own memoir about their childhood called Look Me in the Eye. Now their mother, Margaret Robison, has added to this family saga with her memoir, The Long Journey Home. The three books don't always agree on the details, and they raise questions about truth, memory, and memoirs. NPR's Lynn Neary has the story.
Memoirs, says Lee Gutkin, have to be true. But, says Gutkin, a professor at Arizona State University and a specialist in creative nonfiction, you can't apply journalistic standards to a memoir. There's a difference between facts and the truth.
The truth is what you feel and what you see, but it's your own personal truth, and it is not necessarily factually accurate, and it's not necessarily the truth that other people have possessed and other people discussed. It's your story. That's what a memoir is.
Here's a truth. Augustin Burroughs is a stranger to Margaret Robison. The fact is, she knew her son as Chris Robison, and she has fond, warm memories of him. But the book he wrote under the name Augustin Burroughs hurt her deeply. These days, the two don't talk to each other, and Burroughs doesn't want to talk about his mother's memoir either. He did speak about her a few years back in an interview with Terry Gross on Fresh Air.
My mother, you know, was always very exuberant. You know, she would paint, and if she wasn't painting, she would be writing, and if she wasn't writing, she would spend hours and hours doing a pen and ink illustration, or she'd be talking on the phone. She had, you know, lots of friends. Very, very exuberant, big person. You know, she sort of filled her life with a lot of projects and interests.
But Burroughs went on to say there were many times when the light left her eyes and she got a look that meant that exuberant mother was gone, replaced by a woman with a serious mental illness trapped in a bad marriage.
She had a very difficult marriage with my father, who was a heavy drinker, very, very heavy alcoholic, and a professor. And they sought couples counseling with a psychiatrist.
Because of his family's dysfunction, Burroughs spent much of his teenage years living with that psychiatrist, who he says was like a cult leader. During those years, he had an affair with a much older man, faked an attempted suicide, and dropped out of school. He turned these experiences and more into a dark comedy in his memoir, and he lays much of the blame for what happened on his mother. In her own memoir, Margaret Robison gets a chance to explain her side of the story. But Robison, whose speech has been affected by a stroke, is emphatic that her book is not a response to her son's.
That was not why I wrote the book. I began my book long before Chris began his.
Margaret Robison says she wanted to write the book so she could have a better understanding of her life. Raised by an overly critical mother in a small southern town, she had dreams of being an artist. But in those days, women were expected to marry, so she did. It was a marriage that went bad, but she stayed in it because she felt she had to.
John said he would kill himself if I left him, and I think I believed that. I was also afraid that he might hurt us, because he could be very violent. I cared about him. I didn't want him to kill himself.
Robison says the psychiatrist, who seems like an irresponsible quack in Burroughs' memoir, was, at least in the beginning, a stabilizing force in her life.
Well, I think he actually saved my family's life. He saw my husband's anger. He saw the possibility that he could kill himself or some of us. No one had ever seen that before.
Robison's memoir describes her psychotic breakdowns and the time she spent in mental hospitals, as well as her eventual realization that the psychiatrist was doing more harm than good. Her older son, John Elder Robison, left home at the age of 16 to escape the chaos of his family. But he also remembers that in the beginning, the psychiatrist helped them.
Dr. Turcotte, before he, spiraled into his own nuttiness, Dr. Turcotte was a brilliant guy. My mother says that, and I say that. We agree.
Diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome as an adult, John Elder Robison says he used to be ashamed to talk about his childhood. Now he's written his own memoir and a new book on living with Asperger's called Be Different. He says his brother's book changed the way he thought about his own life.
When my brother published that book, and people began to read it, and they would say things like, oh, you know, I'm just like so impressed that you grew up in those difficult circumstances, and yet you're as successful as you are, I came to realize that our stories could be inspirational and not shameful and humiliating.
John Elder Robison says the memories in each of the books about his family may vary here and there on certain details, but he doesn't think that's really important. For example, he has a vivid memory of his father burning his little brother on the forehead with a cigarette.
So here we have me remembering my brother getting burned on the forehead. We have my first wife remembering me as a teenager having a cigarette burn on my chest. And we have my mother not remembering at all, but my mother, as she says in her book, was in a state of pretty severe disconnection from reality much of the time through mental illness. So does that mean that story's about me? Is it about my brother? Did both of us get burned with cigarettes? I don't know that it's possible to know. No matter what, it's a ugly tale.
It is an ugly tale. That is a fact. And it is also the truth that emerges from all three of these memoirs. Three different writers take the same set of circumstances, and each comes up with a different story. Augustine Burroughs changes his name and applies a comic genius to tell a tale that millions want to read. John Elder Robison discovers that he has something to teach young people struggling with Asperger's. And Margaret Robison finds her salvation in the very act of writing it all down.
Writing was what helped me regain my sanity and leave the hospital the first time. From then on, writing was my essential way of dealing with life.
Memoirs have been much maligned of late because they are all about memory, a notoriously unreliable vehicle for facts, but an endlessly fascinating source of speculation about what really is the truth. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
There's a new Brad Pitt movie in theaters this weekend, but it's not like any Brad Pitt movie you've seen before. It's called The Tree of Life. It just won the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival, and in it, Pitt plays a husband and father who, along with his wife, is raising three boys in 1950s Texas. In the movie, Pitt's character is strict and emotionally distant. He expresses love for his sons openly, but he's got a short temper, and that can be downright frightening at times. At one point, he tries to teach his boys how to fight.
Come on, hit me. Come on. Come on, Jack. Hit me. Hit me. Hit me. Come on. Come on. Hit. Here it is. Here it is. Hit it. Come on, son. Come on. Son, left.
The family's story is at the center of the film, but director Terrence Malick is reaching for a lot more here. Universal questions about nature, science, philosophy, and religion. And Pitt says his character, too, is asking universal questions.
You know, the family lives in the era of the 50s, and what I understand, coming from not a rural area, but at least certainly more southern in its roots, a father's knows best kind of mentality. And the character here in The Tree of Life is someone who feels most oppressed by the world, oppressed by the job. The American dream didn't work out as he believed it would be, quite envious and bitter that people are ahead of him. Naturally, when someone feels oppressed, they find someone weaker to pass that oppression on. And the sadness in this situation, it's on his sons. But here in this moment, he's trying to prepare them for the world as he understands it, and that is that it's a fight, and you're on your own, and you got to take care of yourself.
When you explained this movie to your kids, how did you explain it?
I don't. I haven't even explained what we do for a living to my kids.
Seriously?
Well, they know Mom and Dad, you know, they tell stories, they're in movies. And it's an everyday thing, and it's nothing more than that.
What was the hardest part about making this?
I wouldn't say hard. It was just completely different. You have to understand a movie set is very chaotic. There's hundreds of people. There's generators and trucks. And this was a completely different experience. We had none of that. He rented the neighborhood, this neighborhood that had been cut off by the interstate in the 50s and was ostensibly a time capsule for that era. There were no lights, camera lights, or no generators, and the camera was all handheld. So it was a very a kind of freeform, low-key experience.
You mentioned the fact that you were raised in a fairly rural environment in the Midwest. This takes place in 1950s rural Texas, small-town Texas. Was there anything about that environment, that part of the film, that resonated with you personally?
I had great parallels with this upbringing in sense of environment. Staying out late till the sun went down, hearing your mom's voice call you in, getting into the trouble, breaking windows, firecrackers, playing in cemeteries. You know, if I could feel the bomb in the air on the summer nights. And yes, it's very close to me, so I was quite comfortable.
I want to ask you a little more about the experience of working with Terrence Malick. He is a bit of an anomaly in Hollywood. He's made only five movies in the period of nearly 40 years. A very private man, and he doesn't do press, doesn't do a lot of interviews like this one. And his movies are not exactly the kind of pictures that studios line up to fund. Can you talk a little bit about what was particularly different about working with Terrence Malick?
Terry is all freeform. He's someone who's looking for moments of truth and not created moments of truth, the accidents that happen. So he'll torpedo a scene. By that, I mean he'll push the cameraman beforehand, or he'll, if Jessica and I were having a fight in the first take, he would suddenly send the youngest child in to sit down at the table and would change the whole tenor of the scene. He would throw a dog up in the front seat and laugh. He would just, he's just constantly trying to push people off their comfort zones.
How much time did you spend with the kids, the young actors who are on the film?
Well, we practically lived together every day.
Oh, you lived together?
No, I mean, not literally. We didn't go home together. But, you know, we spent the days together like a family would, playing between takes, playing outside, throwing the ball around. By the way, Terry Malick is a fantastic athlete. As humble and meek as the man seems, he's quite aggressive. He had a ball in his hand.
I want to switch gears a little bit. You've been very involved in the field of architecture. It's something that you're interested in, and you've extended that in your work in Louisiana. There are some interesting parallels between what happened in New Orleans in 2005 in the Hurricane Katrina and this film, The Tree of Life. There's a message in that film that life is finite and can change in an instant, and clearly Hurricane Katrina changed everything for millions of people. Wondering if you can talk a little bit about your experience working in the Gulf. I've actually seen some of those houses that your foundation has been building in the Lower Ninth Ward. And I'm curious to hear from you, 4 years into this, do you think it's having the kind of catalytic effect that you had hoped for?
Well, first I'll say that the film does speak to our impermanence. And I think whenever we see catastrophic events, it again reminds us of our impermanence and fragility. And just like the tornado just hit Joplin, Missouri. So I also draw the parallels there. The project itself has been more successful than I possibly imagined. These homes that have been built are being built for the same price to build an antiquated, non-efficient house where your bills are $300, and here we're seeing families with $30, $20 a month, and so it frees up all this income, extra income for the family. But the real interesting thing, the thing I did not expect, was the feeling in the neighborhood, the feeling in the families, just the what it meant for them for in a place where they're used to being marginalized, for someone to come along and help them out. Just that has seemed to change their life view. And I have to believe that's being passed on.
You've said in other interviews about this film that you wanted this particular movie to start a discussion, to get people to ask big questions. And I wonder what kind of discussion that this film and making it may have provoked in your own life.
During my last viewing of the film, it occurred to me, well, let me back up by saying there's been a lot of theological discussions attached with this film, as I understand it, and spiritual conversations.
There are a lot of religious allegories. There are a lot of questions about, is there a God?
Yeah, and iconography, and sure. And first, what I'll say about what I know about Terry is a man who sees God in science and science in God, and usually these things are opposing forces. But me, for myself, it speaks to the unknown, the things that we cannot define, that it seems to me we try to comfort ourselves with stories that stem from theology or different religions, and that maybe the real peace to be found is in the acceptance of the unknowing, that we don't know, but that there is something, that there's a real power there that's greater than us, and maybe that's enough.
That's Brad Pitt. He stars in the new film, The Tree of Life, which opens in select cities this weekend. Brad, thanks for being here.
All right. Thanks much.
Do what you want to do, what you want to do, do what you want.
Daphne Willis seems to be on the verge of something big. Her debut CD, What to Say, attracted notice last year. She moved from Chicago to Nashville. She surrounded herself with new talent. She began to write more of her own music. And this spring, she's brought out her second album, Because I Can.
Scratching the surface, searching for a purpose. Who do you wanna be? A dip, a chain, a king.
That's Do What You Want from Daphne Willis's new album. And Daphne Willis joins us from NPR West in Culver City, California. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, great to talk to you. And please tell us the story of your discovery, because I gather we're talking to you now because somebody's iPod ran out of juice.
Oh, man, I love the serendipitous nature of the story is great. Kevin Welk, who runs Vanguard Records and owns Welk Music, actually Lawrence Welk's grandson, was on a flight, and his iPod did indeed die. And you could plug your headphones into the armrest or whatever. And one of my songs was playing, and he went into the pamphlet and saw I was unsigned, and that's kind of how it initially started.
So you've been singing since you were a little girl?
Yeah, both my parents had their roots in music, so they both went to the University of Texas. My mom was a vocal performance major, and my dad was an engineering major who also minored in music business and worked at Sony BMG for 30-plus years. So I have an older brother, too, who is also musically inclined. And my parents would rock us out to, like, you know, Elvis Costello and Stevie Wonder and Ella Fitzgerald and, all the great classic songwriters and vocalists. So I kind of grew up surrounded in that world.
Now, at some point, though, did your mother say, if you want to get serious about this, though, it can't be just singing for fun. You've got to put some technique in it?
I mean, certainly there was always this passion for music driving me, but I think that as I grew older, I certainly saw through my dad working in the business that it was very competitive and very difficult. So I actually always kind of planned on it being more or less a hobby. I actually went to DePaul University in Chicago for secondary education, English. And
you're going to be a teacher?
Yeah, I was going to be a teacher. And then it all kind of came about, you know, that Kevin Welk had heard this recording of mine on a flight, and then I was just kind of presented with this huge opportunity, and you know, my parents, of course, were like, do it, go for it, you know, yeah. Very supportive, and so here I am.
Now, of course, we heard a little bit of Do What You Want. You have songs on this album that are unmistakably pop, but other songs, too, but let's listen to this one, Slow Down.
We put in our time, and it seems a shame to keep walking these lines when it just stays the same.
That's a beautiful number.
Thank you.
Show another side of yourself there?
I think it definitely does. Very extreme. I'm a very extreme person. I'm either like really, when I'm doing something, I'm really in it and really doing it. So I think that being able to have a song like Slow Down on the record helps me, as well as I think it also really helps the record to kind of pull it back for a second. We gotta slow.
You got a favorite song on this album?
I really don't. It kind of goes back and forth.
Or they're all your favorites?
They're.
Excuse me, you're new to this business. I've interviewed a lot of musicians. Your answer, Daphne Willis, is to say, you know, Scott, I love all of these songs.
I do. I do love all of the songs. They all represent a different kind of emotion. So it's kind of difficult to kind of just like pick out one, you know, one thing or one emotion when they're all just, you know, part of life.
You push your voice a bit on a couple of numbers, which is a nice thing to hear. Let's listen to a little of the track, Spit It Out. That's quite a range.
Thank you.
How do you do that?
You know, I really think that just, I think it's half genetics and half the fact that I pretty much practice singing every day. And anybody can tell you, getting good at any craft, whether it's music or anything, math, whatever, it just takes a lot of practice. Well, I don't know why you're leaving. No, I don't know. Why you leaving? No, you try to get up all nice and slow, but I don't know why you're leaving. No, say you got somewhere to be, but I really don't want to see you go. Ooh. And it's raining outside anyway. Weatherman said raining all the day. No, it's raining outside anyway. Weatherman said raining all the day. Say you got somewhere to be, but I really don't want to see you go.
I enjoyed doing a little research on you and coming across a video of you singing. You're wearing, or they're not over your eyes, but you've got goggles on your forehead.
I've started kind of collecting them and kind of collecting different styles. And like, so if I'm feeling really dark, I'll put on a really dark pair, you know. Or if I'm feeling like really fun, I've got this pair with like fuzzy, they're like fuzzy goggles. So I'll put those on. And I just think the whole thing has probably gotten out of control, which is a good thing. Definitely a good thing.
Well, it's good shtick. Daphne Willis, so nice to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
Daphne Willis, your new CD, Because I Can. You can hear more cuts from the CD on our website, npr.org. Daphne Willis joined us from California.
Time now for our latest home video recommendation. Bob Mondello spent much of his Memorial Day weekend holed up with a new 10-DVD set, Stanley Kubrick, The Essential Collection.
Think of all the movie moments Stanley Kubrick gave us.
I'm Spartacus! I'm Spartacus! I'm Spartacus!
Hey, what about Major Kong?
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Here's Johnny!
Also, Lolita, Barry Lyndon, Full Metal Jacket, Kubrick created some of the 20th century's most distinctive and distinctively different films, 9 of which are included here. From epic to satire to sci-fi to horror, this director did everything brilliantly and originally. While other filmmakers copy each other, Kubrick quotes only himself.
Are you Quilty? No, I'm Spartacus.
a little ad-libbed joke to set a comic tone for Lolita in case someone wandered in expecting nothing but sex. In addition to gorgeous remasterings of all the films, there are some nifty extras, especially in the limited edition Blu-ray set, which has additional hours of interviews and scenes movie audiences never heard, like this one, offering a few extra lines when Charles Laughton's Roman senator commits suicide in Spartacus.
There's nothing more we can do for you.
The new master of Rome will be calling on me tomorrow. He wants me to make a speech. When I meet you in paradise, describe to me the expression on his face when he saw me dead.
Even the regular DVD collection has plenty to recommend it, like the story of how Kubrick cobbled together different cameras to do the supposedly impossible, shoot scenes by candlelight in Barry Lyndon, and shots of the huge cream pie fight that became the most famous unseen sequence in movie history. It was supposed to reduce Dr. Strangelove's war room to chaos, and would have, except the actors couldn't stop laughing. Instead, Kubrick came up with the more chilling ending that arguably makes the film the masterpiece it is.
I have a plan. Monsieur has unlocked!
9 movies, each controversial on first release, some of the best of them critically panned, and every one of them now imitated and celebrated. The title gets it right. Stanley Kubrick, The Essential Collection. I'm Bob Mondello.
This Memorial Day weekend, techno music comes home to Detroit. Techno's futuristic sound was nurtured by African Americans in Detroit in the 1980s, but today most of its audience is in Europe. Except this weekend, techno fans will swarm to Detroit for the annual Movement Electronic Music Festival. Wills Glass-Spiegel reports on Detroit's lesser-known export.
In the late 70s, a DJ in Detroit named Electrifying Mojo put something on the radio that had never been heard before. It was Jimi Hendrix plus Philip Glass, Kraftwerk plus Rick James and the B-52s on a spaceship.
I am Mojo.
Mojo's sci-fi persona dominated Detroit's urban radio. The pieces he assembled became the raw materials for techno, and Juan Atkins is often called the first techno artist.
It was just a natural progression for me to make futuristic music.
In 1981, Atkins was 19 years old and technology obsessed. He co-produced Alleys of Your Mind on a rudimentary drum machine.
Yeah, so Mojo, man, dropped Alleys of Your Mind on his radio show. And it just blew up. Nobody knew that this was some black kids from Detroit making this record, man. They thought it was like from Europe.
Through Mojo's radio show, the alien sounds of techno piqued the interest of Detroit natives. But the music's largest audience was quickly established in Europe.
I'm fortunate because I exported my business. If I kept it in the U.S., we would have failed a long time ago.
That's Carl Craig, one of techno's biggest ambassadors. In addition to making music, Craig runs a record label that he started 2 decades ago in Detroit. Last year, they shipped nearly 20,000 vinyl records out of the city. 70% went to Europe, where Craig is a star in Berlin and Paris. But in Detroit, his profile's low-key, his studio an anonymous bunker near a slew of abandoned buildings.
I mean, you go around the block from here and there's buildings that are, you know, the windows are blown out, they've been abandoned for 30 years. My music has always been, for me, a personal beautification of Detroit.
He's not the only one to sense possibility in the rubble. There's a small but steady stream of techno tourists that visit Detroit. Nicole Stagg hosts visitors through the website couchsurfing.com.
We've had like several people that have come from, you know, Germany and mostly from Europe, but specifically for the techno scene here.
They come to see the abandoned factories where parties happened and to visit Detroit's techno landmark, Submerge. The Submerge building houses an iconic label, studios, a techno museum, and a record shop on Detroit's east side. Label manager Cornelius Harris says Submerge defies negative trends in Detroit and in the music industry itself.
The key with being able to function in Detroit is not to look at what it is, but to understand what's possible and to move from that place. People in music do it all the time. They do it every day, which is what's always amazing to me, that you've got this thing that just doesn't exist and you bring it into existence. That's the definition of magic.
Thank you. That's Falling Up by local artist Theo Parrish. It could be a metaphor for Detroit. Parrish is a torchbearer for his city's music, but he hardly ever plays there. His regular gig is at a club called Plastic People in London. For NPR News, this is Wills Glasspiegel.
And at nprmusic.org, you can hear 10 songs that define Detroit's techno sound.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulaby. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.